This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight we're talking with Gordon White, and this is part one of a two-part interview with Gordon. Patrons will get the whole interview right away, plus an extra 20 minutes or so of conversation at the end. Gordon does a very good podcast called Rune Soup, R-U-N-E, soup.com. If you like what he's talking about here, if you like talking about esoterica and magic and stuff like that, his is the podcast to check out. It's very, very good. In the coming weeks, we will have David Politis back on the show. We're going to have Steph Young back on the show. Eventually, we're going to have Peter Robbins and hopefully Rich Dolan back on the show. And speaking of the two of them, they are going to be appearing somewhat locally to the upstate New York area. It's in Kingston, New York. It is the Friday and Saturday, July 29th and 30th. It's a two-day UFO conference. On Friday is the true story of Travis Walton. And then on Saturday, it's there are five speakers. Jen Steen, Peter Robbins, Richard Dolan, Dr. Nathan Rosenblum, and Laird Scranton. So if you're interested in that, and you're in the upstate New York area, it's www.cstapes.com. Yes, cstapes.com. So cstapes.com. And it looks like a pretty good conference. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to attend. I was trying to make it work, but it's just not going to happen. But if you can, there you go. It's in Kingston, New York. It's the first one. So hopefully, if it's successful, there'll be more in the future. All right. Now, with that out of the way, here's part one of Joshua Cutchin and I talking with Gordon White. So we are talking with Gordon White, and you're talking to us from Australia, right, Gordon?
Yes, as of about 3 weeks ago, and it's 8 a.m. here.
Wow. All right. And I'm joined with Joshua Cutchin.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.
Who, if anyone has listened to any previous show recently, you'll know Joshua absolutely loves your work.
Well, that's very nice.
I've been on the Gordon White train for a little while, and I'm trying to spread the word.
That's not to say I don't, but you are one of those go-tos for Joshua here. So,
well, that's always really nice to hear.
And Rune Soup is an excellent podcast that you host. How often do you do it?
It comes out.
It's not every week, is it?
No, it is. It comes out every week on a Thursday. Okay. The challenge with that is that I moved to another hemisphere, so Thursday is now Wednesday for most of the world.
Yeah, I guess it would be, huh? Huh. And how long have you been doing Rune Soup?
The blog has been going for quite some time. So it started as a blog maybe 2008. It started after I got made redundant from Discovery Channel, and I had sort of 6 months to kind of do other things, and I sort of filled my day doing that. People still blogged in 2008, but the show itself has been going for since about last October.
Okay, and how many books do you have out?
I have two books out, The Chaos Protocols and Starships, A Prehistory of the Spirits. I have a third one called Pieces of Eight, which is coming out in the next couple of weeks now that I have a house that I can sit in and actually finish it and get the copy editing done and all that kind of thing.
All right. The first one, I assume, is on chaos magic.
It's a book written by a chaos magician, but it's not actually about chaos magic. It's sort of techniques for Well, the front cover, which, I mean, I didn't come up with the subheading, but my publisher did, but it's Magical Techniques for Navigating the New Economic Reality. So if you consider magic, probably because historically people who have been economically and politically disenfranchised are the ones who typically use it, isn't very good at keeping up with economics. So you have these kind of put a dollar under the candle suggestions in a world that's sort of barreling towards a global digital currency. And so there's a massive disconnect between the sort of application of practical enchantments and the economic kind of landscape that these enchantments are supposed to work in. So the book is wider in that sense. It's about repositioning people who are magically operants heads around these new economic opportunities and risks. And I'm possibly making this sound boring, but that's the general idea. Pieces of Eight, which is the one that's coming out in a couple of weeks, that's the Chaos Magic book.
Okay, all right. Do you find it hard? Let's define for people what chaos magic is.
Chaos magic is a school, if you will, or a movement or subgrouping of, generally speaking, Western magic, which emerged in the UK in the 80s, largely as a response to the moribund state of Western magic at the time. It had just sort of crawled out of the 70s with Age of Aquarius stuff, and in terms of sort of Thelemic magic and the Golden Dawn. Typically with magicians, you have much drama, much interpersonal, crazy drama, and the sort of chaos magic ethic emerged from people who were largely done with the drama, and I was about to use a swear word, I forgot we're on radio, and started to experiment with the sort of structure of magic. So it is very focused on, rather than kind of concealing failed results in some sort of mysticism, like, well, perhaps now I'm more advanced and I don't need these things, it really doubled down in an almost scientific, methodological way in seeing if practical enchantments can be improved, what they can do to work, what you can drop off and what you can retain. So it sort of goes in and out on things like astrology. And it emerged from a group of people who were essentially experimenting with the magical process in a basement in Stoke Newington. So it's this weird mix of, I guess, a northern sensibility in a North London squat, and it retains that idea. So chaos magic is a subsection or a subgrouping of what you might call the Western magical tradition.
Okay, all right. I actually kind of just did it on my own before I knew there was any such thing as chaos magic, ironically.
Well, I think that's a very good way of doing it. And I think that probably describes 90% of people who are in some sense magically operant in the Western world.
I found it amusing when I'd pick up a book on chaos magic and it would have all these strict rituals and things like that. And it's like, isn't this completely defeating the purpose
potentially
of what chaos magic is?
Well, not if it works. So chaos magic kind of went through phases. And the first phase was the one I just described in sort of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then what you have, its founder, well, there are several founders, but the kind of guy who's sort of blamed for the existence of chaos magic, Peter J. Carroll, he self-published or sort of very... there was only a couple of hundred copies of the first few Chaos Magic books, like Liber Chaos and Liber Null and Psychonaut, and then Weiser picked them up and turned them into books. And so Chaos Magic kind of got a second phase, an international phase in the 90s, where largely, and you know, not a burn, but largely in the US, the freedom was widely misinterpreted as you can just do anything. And that's not quite actually what it's about. It's much stricter than that. You need to find the things that work and do them. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the history of magic, which, for instance, Starships adds something to, I hope, there are certain components of it that are conserved across time. And that's probably for a very good reason. It's probably because they work better than just doing some kind of hey, wackadoo, let's invoke Superman thing. And that was that sort of that second phase, which emerged in that bizarre crossover period between the sort of appearance of desktop publishing and the very early days of the internet, where people started doing zines and there were BBS groups and that kind of thing. And Chaos Magic had a wayward adolescence when the stuff that was being shared around was pretty much that sort of nonsense. It's, if you look at the books that, for instance, P.D.J. Carroll's written in the last 5-6 years, you see that there is a it's evolved, and that intellectual and practical rigorousness remains, as well as the sort of iconoclasm that upsets the sort of more order-based magic like the OTO and the Golden Dawn.
You know, the way that, I mean, being a neophyte among neophytes, I mean, I'm very, very green when it comes to all this, but being a professional musician, I sort of think of it almost sort of like in terms of sort of the musical revolutions that we've had, not necessarily popular music revolutions, but like it, especially in like the classical realm, how, you know, you're still using the same 12 pitches. It's just being put together in a different way. And, you know, you could sorry, go ahead.
No, I just have to jump in there and 150% agree, because I went to film school. And so I've actually used this analogy in Pieces of Eight when it comes out, which is, when I went to film school, I was told you have to learn the classical techniques before you can subvert them, or otherwise you've made SH1T. I was about to swear again. And that's chaos magic to a T. If you start, and unfortunately, no one in film school listens, of course, and they go out and make garbage. And it's hopefully towards the end of your degree, you realize, oh, I guess my tutor in first year was correct. And I do need to know things like how to light correctly and how to audio record correctly to make something correct, and then I can experiment from that. And that's I think, given the fact that a lot of people say Alan Moore is the most famous example, consider magic to be wholly art, some sort of mixture of performance and interpretation, then a lot of those classical rules that would apply to music or filmmaking certainly apply to magic.
Yeah, that's I think that's a good way to contextualize it.
And I think I actually found out about chaos magic through Liber Null and Psychonaut, and I think I was made aware of that from Fields of the Nephilim.
Oh, well, people come to it all kinds of ways, I guess.
Yeah, because they did a song called Psychonaut, and I went, what is Psychonaut? And then I saw there was a book and went, huh, let's look at the book. And then I read the book and went, I'm already doing this.
Yeah. To be fair, I'm pretty sure the word predates the book. I'm sure that's I'm sure someone like Robert Anton Wilson or whatever has used the word psychonaut before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that's exactly where he got it from. It's just that when I was looking up trying to find out what the word meant and where the origins came from, I came across that book, and that's what made me aware of there actually being something called chaos magic.
Well, these are how these things are found, I guess. That's quite good.
Now, Starships, you want to give people just a general idea of what Starships is about?
Sure. So Starships is my first book, published by Scarlet Imprint, and it was out earlier this year. The subheading is A Prehistory of the Spirits. Now, the world of magic, and I guess the world of alternative history, is something I've been interested in since I was a kid. And there is a kind of time delay in how the alternative world uses data. So if you look at the kind of ancient aliens milieu, it's relying on information like genetic and archaeological information from the late 60s or early 70s. And it really hasn't been updated since Zechariah Sitchin. Now, as I'm sure Josh will agree, because his first book is aligned in this opinion, the physical alien or extraterrestrial hypothesis interpretation of anomalous historical data is very unsophisticated. It's what happens when you try to find the anomalous and remain within a materialist context. And it occurred to me that no one had really put this together from the position of someone who was magically operant. And there's been some amazing books that Scarlet Imprint has previously put out. So Geosophia, which is a two-book kind of collection from a writer called Jake Stratton Kent, deals with the history and origins of the grimoire spirits, for instance. And he starts the story in archaic Greece, and quite correctly so, with the sort of the word Goetia emerges from an ancient Greek word to do with sort of funeral rites and that kind of thing. Now, Greece or ancient Greece never met somebody else's idea they didn't like. So you can start the story in archaic Greece, but it's not the beginning of the spirits. What you find if you're interested in history is that it appears that no one ever really invented anything, because you can find that you keep just sort of stepping back either a century or a millennia and so on. And I could see, as a result of the sort of emerging geological information, the emerging genetic information and linguistics and new ways of interpreting the origins of mythology, that if you kind of layer these data sets together, a new picture starts to emerge of just how old either the beings or the practices that we now have in the Western magical tradition actually are. And so Starships, A Prehistory of the Spirits, is essentially the story of the origins, very specifically, of the Western magical tradition. But it does go the entire way back to our departure out of Africa between 70 and 90,000 years ago. And there's kind of a little hint. It's a hint before that. So it's kind of ancient aliens for people who are a little bit beyond the extraterrestrial hypothesis, put it that way.
Yeah. And you do a fabulous job of tracking down and mixing together some of the sort of accepted scientific data and the alternative theories, and then going further with it by looking at the myths, the legends, the language, and so on and so forth.
Well, thank you for saying so. Yeah. I think for anyone who's interested in alternate history, and this is sort of an echo of something Dr. Rupert Sheldrake said about science, scientists should, like, all science degrees should in many respects be postgraduate, and the undergraduate being a history degree, and that history being the history of science. And when it comes to being interested in alternate history, I think people need a very strong grounding in historiography, so the actual story of history, because otherwise you end up in the situation where you kind of pick data from the mid-20th century that's either been improved or abandoned, and you end up all the way out in Zechariah Sitchin land, where there are nuclear-powered rocket ships coming to mine gold to save an atmosphere, and that's because the data set that you're built from is incomplete and old. So the general kind of hope with Starships, and funnily enough, speaking of Josh's book again, which I appear to be selling, the same idea is in play here, which is, well, okay, let's just everyone cool your jets for a minute, and let's look at the actual data we have today in the 21st century and start to build the analysis and hypotheses on top of that, rather than getting caught running down very unsatisfying rabbit holes that have not really led anywhere in the last 40 years.
Yeah.
I tend to evaluate certain ideas and theories based on basically how well all the parts move together within a certain worldview, a certain model. And what I found in Starships is that there's such an internal consistency. I mean, it really does sort of remind me of a lot of the way that that Patrick Harper wrote Demonic Reality, the other book that I'm always that I'm always talking about on this
That's
podcast.
A great book. Not gonna lie.
Starships, in a lot of ways, reminds me of sort of the ideas in Demonic Reality because of its internal consistency. There's always a certain way to there's always a certain logic within this worldview that's espoused that completely, totally makes sense within the confines of this particular idea. So, you know, I have fantastic things to say about it, and I guess I just said them, but
well, yeah, comparison to Patrick Harper is welcome in high praise.
And one of the things you start out with in here is that you start to kind of point out the ridiculousness of looking for the truth in older legends, like the literal truth.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the main ways that alternative history has landed on this very materialist extraterrestrial hypothesis. Not entirely. Obviously, there are people out there that don't, but they don't tend to end up on the TV shows. And that idea is essentially a Renaissance survival. It's not quite... So we're kind of caught in this infinite loop. If you consider what happened during the Renaissance, when the Corpus Hermeticum and Plato and so on are being discovered and imported into Florence and translated from Greek and so on into Latin and being shared around, you had this is, and by the way, at the time they couldn't read hieroglyphs, and they couldn't for several more centuries. So you have this idea that the past has all this ancient wisdom that they're trying to recover. And that idea has sort of remained as the sort of eternal spiritual quest since the Renaissance. And it hasn't really been updated since we were able to read hieroglyphs and so on. So looking for literal interpretations of a myth is very dangerous, because you just kind of have to pick one that you like. And there are a lot of myths in the world, and then all of a sudden it becomes real. And the bit that I find particularly frustrating is if you're looking for people who declare they found the original Garden of Eden or so on, that is, by the time the Garden of Eden story emerged in Israelite mythology, it's a very old survival from Babylon and before that from Samaria, and where did the Sumerians get it from? And all of a sudden you're dealing with it's elephants all the way down. And I was looking, so Starships of Prehistory, the spirits is actually going, well, it's fine that a myth can occasionally describe things that have happened. I believe, as I'm sure you guys do, there's a very good case to be made that the end of the Ice Age is retained in quite a number of myths around the world.
Right.
So that's fine. I think myth can do many things, one of which is to record serious climatic events that humans have experienced. But if you just kind of pick one variant of a flood myth or a forgotten civilization myth and then kind of do a Google image search for archaeological structures that bear a passing resemblance to it, you're not heading anywhere very satisfying or useful.
Right. Okay. And there's also, I can't remember the name of the chapter. Essentially, one day, maybe you called it One Casket at a Time.
One Funeral at a Time.
Yeah. One Funeral at a Time. Okay. Where, and this seems to be true in a lot of realms of science, both, archaeology, cosmology, and earth sciences in general, that new ideas just aren't welcome. You have to wait for the older people who are holding the dogma in place to die before these new ideas can even get a foothold in there.
Yes. Yeah, so the title is a reference to a sort of famous thing that Max Planck said about science progresses one funeral at a time, as a paraphrase. And it's exactly as you described, but it's not just science. It's any kind of belief system or mythology that is based on a power hierarchy. So you find the same thing in the humanities, you find the same thing in religions, anything where it's particularly acute in academia, because if you consider the career path of an academic, they essentially have to climb a ladder it's based on a medieval church model. So they have to climb a ladder by sort of appealing to people who are the next level up above them, whose ideas they kind of obviously have to like, or otherwise you don't get the job. And so you have this structure that is not very well suited to innovation, because especially, and once they get to 50, that's it. I mean, you can't turn around when you have tenure and you're a few days or a few years away from retirement and go, well, I guess I wasted my life. And there's a very real human part in that, which is a stringent resistance. When Pasteur discovered germs, well, when he first came up with the idea, I think there are these tiny, invisible microorganisms that cause disease, and everyone in the sort of academy in France was like, this man is a lunatic. And then, of course, thanks to kind of improved microscope technology, they started to be seen. And I can't remember the name of the guy off the top of my head, but his main detractor, when the rest of the academy is like, well, I looked in the microscope and there were some germs, refused to look in the microscope. He's like, no, 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 they don't exist. And he wouldn't look in the microscope. That is the shape of science. That's kind of how it works. And this is sort of to my point, or Dr. Sheldrake's point, about if you want to be a scientist, you really should spend a couple of years studying the history of science, because, and this is what's so wonderful about it, it is a graveyard of wrong ideas. You aren't taught that. You aren't taught that when you go to science school. You're taught what you are learning right now is correct. And right. It's never been correct, never. That's what's so powerful about science. It should be what you are learning right now is our best guess, but let's be honest, for the last 300 years, we've been wrong about every single thing. So...
yeah, it's almost as if, in a lot of ways, science is consistently on the wrong side of history. So even if you're generous to it, at the very best, it's sort of this Hegelian dialectic sort of evolving model, which I think by definition means that what was once part and parcel several generations on does completely change. But I would also sort of add a caveat that you've talked about a lot of times, is that this is definitely like the establishment public persona of capital S science, and not really what happens when you talk to people on an individual basis. I mean, when you do talk to people on an individual basis, it's very much akin to something that Alex Sakaris on the Skeptico podcast always likes to talk about is the fact that lots of times religious folks don't always adhere to the religious dogma when you get them alone, you know, when they're being really honest with their own emotions. And I think that science in a lot of ways is that way too. If you can pull somebody to the side and, you know, actually have a conversation with them, they'll be much more willing to admit that the world is a lot stranger. Similarly with you know, you look at abduction researchers, even nuts and bolts abduction researchers, you can pull them aside sometimes in private and say, "This is, you really think this is what's going on?" And they'll admit that it's a lot stranger than they put on as their public face.
I absolutely agree. It's that same sort of power structure. And over the course of writing the book, I spoke to Oxford geneticists who were part of the Out of Africa project. I spoke to Egyptologists. And every time you pull them aside and you get the whole, well, here's the official position, which is the one I need to not get fired. My favorite one was Dr. Irving Finkel from the British Museum, who I think he's been promoted, but he's basically one of the Assyriologists in the British Museum. Now that, if you're an Assyriologist, is like a top job. And we're at his book launch in London a couple of years ago, and his book, which is lovely, it's called The Ark Before Noah. And I said, so in your book, the earliest version of the Noah myth you have, the animals that are on the boat are all pre-domesticated. They're all wild animals. There are no sheep or cows or anything. They are, you know, auroch and, right, and elk and so on. This, to me, implies the story is a survival, like the earliest versions of the story, or it is a survival of a tale that was told prior to the domestication of animals. And he kind of looked at me and he's like, well, and it, classic academic answer, which is, well, that's a huge topic and a discussion, and what I think you do, we were at Treadwell's bookstore in London, and he said, what I think you should do is talk to Treadwell's, and they'll have me back, and we can spend a day thrashing these ideas around, which is academic speak for, you are correct, please do not ask me about it, because I work for the British Museum, and I will kill you if you, you know, get in the way of my job. And to be fair, it's a great job and a great institution. I probably would have done the same. But that's an example of pulling an academic who very much knows his apples aside and going, look, this isn't in the book, but this is a thing, right? And he's like, yeah.
Right. And it's interesting. Like, if you've ever worked in academia, I don't think people who haven't been on campus seeing how the sausage is made really understand quite how suffocating it can be. And I think that perhaps, if anything, in the past few months in this country, at least, has really revealed itself, it's the fact that academia is sort of slowly collapsing like a flan in a cupboard. It's sort of cannibalizing itself in a lot of ways, just in terms of campus culture and in terms of this sort of Ouroboros of, you know, cranking out academics to teach more academics to, you know, this yeah, incestuous cycle of just putting people back through the revolving door.
It's emerging. It's true kind of state function as producers of official reality or stamps of official reality is becoming clearer and clearer as the official reality, the mask is slipping from official reality in the West, and particularly in the US at the moment. And when that happens, people behave in very panicked and destructive ways. And yes, academia is eating itself and collapsing. And in many respects, it's good that that's happening. I mean, I'm, you know, sorry for the people who will lose their jobs and so on. But toxic structures need to collapse so that better ones can be rebuilt. And Egyptology is a very good example of this, where you will, like, there is never a bigger gap in the kind of official narrative of history and what people privately think than in Egypt, because the official one just couldn't be more wrong. And an Egyptologist with an IQ of 105 and up will tell you this. And it's interesting. I actually, when I had Dr. Kreipel on the show, we were talking about this. Academics need a space that isn't the academy where they can say these things, be they religious studies, be they Egyptologists and so on. And in Egyptology's case, that space isn't there yet, because if you look at quote-unquote official Egyptology, which is essentially a subsection of Egypt's tourist board. It's just not even a real discipline at this point in time. If you look at alternative Egyptology, too much of it is the ancient aliens world for them to come out and go, well, hang on, let's... the official narrative is broken to the point where it needs to be brought down, but I'm not going to go and stand next to the guy who's saying I'm not saying it's aliens.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think too there's an issue with this, like, this forced dichotomy of you know, you either have to believe in science, but if you question it, then you're not being scientific. And there's nothing wrong with the scientific method itself, but we forget that there are people behind that scientific method that have all kinds of agendas and biases, whether they're conscious or not. And that dichotomy of you're either, you know, fully scientific or you believe in aliens is illusionary.
Well, this kind of science with a trademark next to it, this sort of official science, people seem to think, people who don't understand science very well, which includes science journalists and people who write for major papers, think science and materialism are the same thing, and they're not. But they will defend it. It's that classic David Icke thing. They defend the first domino. Science is there to support materialism, which, as far as I'm concerned, is entirely falsified. They cannot let that domino fall, because you very quickly collapse into a magical reality, whether you're an idealist or an animist, as I am, or any of that stuff. If materialism is wrong, and it's been wrong for philosophers since the 70s, like, honestly, the only place materialism really survives is in The Guardian. And they can't let that go, because it invites a complete reposition of what is and isn't important on a philosophical and personal basis in the world, and that's not very good for selling iPhones.
Yeah, I'm constantly bewildered by how often people are willing to sort of prop this up, and it doesn't pass the smell test anymore. And it really is this idea that if one falls, so falls everything else. And I a lot of people toss around language about quantum mechanics, and I'm always hesitant to ever bring that up, because it's really easy to paint yourself into a corner and look like an idiot throwing these words around. Especially when you don't completely fully understand them. But even with a cursory understanding of the implications of many quantum ideas, really does it means that we can't really bet on anything. I mean, you know, if I sit down in the chair, I'm probably not going to fall between the atoms in the chair. But it really calls everything into question. The fact that, you know, we have an influence upon our environment as observers, and it reminds me of a wonderful Terence McKenna quote, where he talks about how you can never ever really know the universal mystery. You just have a lot of shingles that you epoxy onto the face of the mystery, and then once you can't see it anymore, you say it's solved. And I feel like that's what we've been doing in the past 150 years.
Yeah, and to extend St. Terence's quote there, we haven't used a very high-quality glue. And so some of those shingles are now falling off. And that's the bit that's... And it's not just, Guardian science writers and former defense contractors who wear bow ties on TV and tell you what does and doesn't exist. I find... When I first realized that... Let me back this up. So... Much as I hate to do this, because I think people use the wrong metaphor from The Matrix, the films, right? If you recall when, like, Neo's being trained and he's being told that there are people in there who are happy in there, and if they're not awake, they're essentially, they can not really be enemies, but, like, they can be. They're kind of dangerous. And I was talking to a friend of mine in London years ago, and it's basic stuff. We're not even out on the fringe yet, which was Wernher von Braun, who's obviously the founder and the guy who ran the Apollo program, was a SS major and a Nazi. And she just freaked out. She's like, don't tell me that. I don't want to hear that. I'm like, that's interesting. Like, I haven't even gone anywhere weird with Matt. Like, this is just basic science. And I think that the defense of the first domino is not just an official reality position. I think a lot of people are happy with that domino standing because the necessary philosophical repositioning of what is important to them in life really quickly changes. And that's one of the things that kind of makes you a bit sanguine about whether we're on the edge of some golden age of thinking about consciousness as a component of reality, because most people don't care.
And there's a profound irony in the fact that so many people that you talk to are very anti, well, just to be simple, anti-woo, but they end up falling into these same cults of personality that we have with these bow tie wearing people on TV. I think we all know who you're talking about. But there are. It's so ironic that you will find people who are shouting down cult leaders who also are all about, you know, they have Neil deGrasse Tyson as their Facebook cover photo. You know, it's a real disconnect there in terms of buying what people say hook, line, and sinker. And again, this isn't me being a science denier or paranoid, but it's,
well, no, Neil deGrasse Tyson is science denying. You're not. Like, it is literally a cult. And
it's hard, it's effing spooky science.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's a cult. That's what it is. And it is a cult for dumb people to think they're smart. That's the appeal of it. That's where, when people are like liking or sharing some kind of I effing love science nonsense. I mean, I haven't used Facebook for years, and one of the many reasons is things like that. Also, I don't like looking at other people's children, but this information, like, you look at it and go, that's not correct, and you're celebrating it. Science has become a magic word, like, stand back, I'm going to do science. And I'm like, this is how dumb people see science. Neil deGrasse Tyson is there for dumb people to think they're smart.
Right.
That's the appeal of the cult. It's I am saved. Well, it's the same shape of it.
It's keeping them from having to think for themselves.
Yeah, just like a cult.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Let's dig into starships a little bit here, and let's go right back to the beginning. I mean, we were talking ancient aliens, but realistically, what do you think? Where do you think our culture comes from? Do you think there was a civilization pre-Ice Age that was advanced enough to encode stuff for us, or encode their knowledge into myths and such?
I don't think they did that consciously. The short answer, like, the word civilization is challenging, and funnily enough, in that chapter we were just talking about, One Funeral of a Time, at a Time, we kind of go through where that word comes from and the political implications of it, and how it was used in the myth of progress, which is kind of moves in lockstep with the Darwinian narrative that we've sort of just been talking about as being the first domino. So I go out of my way to not use the word civilization in the book when dealing with, say, Paleolithic cultures. I use the word culture, and I don't use the word technology. I use the word complexity. I gave a presentation at the London Occult Conference at the end of last month where I kind of go into why that is the case. Technology implies things that trap you into thinking in the myth of progress, whereas cultural complexity is essentially just the velocity of new things in a culture. So you don't have to be in a situation of going, well, is an iPhone more important than a 5,000-year-old hunting song? And I don't think it is, but both of these things are an example of cultural complexity. So the short answer is yes. I don't think there was the alternate history, say, view that someone like Graham Hancock goes in and out on, which is that there was this, high antiquitous civilization that realized it was in decline and kind of gave all its ideas to some smart people and they sent them off on boats and that seeded culture in the earth. That is not a very good or a very sophisticated read of the data. What is emerging is that there are some beliefs and folk tales and nursery rhymes and all these kind of ideas that have probably survived a lot longer than the arbitrarily defined definition of the beginning of quote-unquote civilization at around 3500 BC. The classic example is the stork delivering the baby. And in Germany, there's an additional component to the stork delivering the baby myth theme, which is it basically picks it up from a lake where babies come from. Now, if you look at the work of Harvard Indologist Dr. Witzel, he suggests, and I think correctly, that this is a survival of the Well of Souls idea that you find in sub-Saharan Africa. So there's this story we tell kids about storks delivering babies that is 70,000 years old. Now, the people who were telling this story in sub-Saharan Africa before we left Africa didn't sit around and go, our culture might collapse. We should tell a smart person the story about the Well of Souls and send them on this journey around the world. It didn't happen, but the story survived. And I think, if anything, that is what Starships tries to convey, which is, yes, a lot of these things which we recognize are ideas or concepts that are much older than Sumer or Egypt or the Indus Valley cultures. They are much older. That doesn't necessarily imply that there was an Atlantis where, you know, some wizards, kind of like the beginning of Superman, where some wizards were given this information and off they go around the world. That doesn't necessarily have to have happened. All we need to do is pull the timelines back and credit our Paleolithic ancestors with the same level of curiosity and interest in art and culture and sex and all the things that we like that we do today. I mean, let's be clear, they had bigger brains than ours. It wasn't even that they were the same size brains. What that implies about their consciousness capacities is that they are the same or better than ours. And I'm interested in things like storytelling and sex and what are stars and, you know, why is the sky blue and how does this all work? And it's the arbitrary definition that we need to erase, and we find that. And I find very enriching and kind of inspiring that the thing that survives through time is not the answer. This gets back to my Renaissance thing, which is the belief that there's some kind of ancient wisdom or ancient answer emerged as all these texts were being translated. And we're like, oh, goodness, look how smart these people were. It's not the answer that survives through time. It's the question. And that's lovely.
Well, yeah. And just getting back to sort of what you were talking about, you know, about, I think that some fundamentals of mankind don't change. And I can't see our culture having this, this ideal of wanting to preserve our knowledge. If I can see our culture doing that, then I don't think an elder culture would have done that either. What I can think of is our culture wanting to pass on, entertainment, wanting to preserve stories and relationships, which in them have a sort of almost hermetic, as above, so below, microcosm of the way that our world really does work and the way that we understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the survivals are in that way. So as I referenced Dr. Witzel, I have a whole chapter on his thesis because I think it's very important. And he wrote a book called The Origins of the World's Mythologies, which I recommend everyone read. But he delineates between what he calls grandfather tales and grandmother tales. Grandfather tales are the official stories. They're the stories of the shamans. They're like, this is how the world works. This is what the spirit being we descended from. And that shape of a story, much because that's essentially the science of the time, that shape of the story will morph as the politics of a tribe or city or nation morphs. And our version of a grandfather story now is the scientific materialism that we see on television. Grandmother stories are the ones that are not politically important. They're the stories that you give to women and women tell them to babies. And that's where you find most of the longer lived survivals, like the stork delivering the baby, because they're not politically important as the politics change. And it's there's something delightfully witchcrafty about it, which is that that idea that true stories of power and depth and philosophy are retained because, you know, the men are too busy picking who's king. And I find that quite nice. And that is sort of what you were saying, which is these stories that were important to maybe you as a child growing up, you're more likely to convey to your child or your grandchild. And right. As a result, we have a much cleaner kind of descent from where these stories presumably originated to where they are in culture. Tolkien said the same thing. He referred to sort of children's stories as the furniture in the nursery. And what he meant by that is that furniture, I mean, you've got a picture in early to mid 20th century English house. Furniture begins its story in say, the living room. So you have a couch and a table and what have you in the living room. And then you replace the couch and the table. So the couch and the table then move to maybe someone's bedroom, or as it gets more and more worn, and furniture ends up in the nursery because the kids can knock it around and so on. But it's still that it's the original couch. And that's the story of how this kind of mythology survives in folk tales and so on.
Okay. One of the things you deal with is the fact that we're looking, for instance, at the out of Africa theory, but we're not fully looking at all the other variations of humans that may have been around pre-end of Ice Age.
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the reasons why I actually went to Oxford and spoke to the guys, because there are some challenges in the timeline that make people dismiss the Art of Africa data, basically. And it's fairly well corroborated. Like, it's one of the things I sort of mentioned in the book. I don't think genes do what Neil deGrasse Tyson thinks they do. Nevertheless, they exist. So we can use them mathematically to work things out about where we come from, because there's a sort of reasonable amount of mutation between generations that you can guess. And you can build a timeline that's within 20 years reasonably, 20,000 years rather, reasonably accurate. And when you're dealing with very long timelines, that's quite close. So we did a group of everyone who is alive outside of Africa today, unless they are descendants of Africans who subsequently left more than 70,000 years ago, have genetic markers that demonstrate that we did in fact originate from a group of probably under 2,000 people, 70 to 90,000 years ago in a kind of central East Africa area. Fine. There are, however, archaeological data points such as fire pits that are 150,000 years old, or the recently discovered Neanderthal ritual circle in Brunichel Cave in France that's 177,000 years old. So we did not leave Africa and wander through an unpopulated land. We left Africa and encountered other things, and we had a lot of sex with them. I mean, we got the sort of code that's associated with our immune system. We got from interbreeding with Neanderthals and Denisovans, and that admixture is highest in island Southeast Asia, which is essentially where we went. We sort of got out of Africa, turned right and jogged along the beach and got to where sort of Sumatra and Indonesia are now. Fairly quickly, within a few thousand years. And it was there that we seem to have encountered, like sexually encountered, more hominins than anywhere else. So it's interesting that now that we're starting to find evidence of, like, so the Neanderthal had magic circles in caves. Like, that's magic. That is literally the same as Western magic. And they were doing it 177,000 years ago in what is now France. So we're not only having sex with these people who cast magic circles, we're obviously interbreeding with them enough to get genetic information. That does presuppose, for instance, that we may have either we had a cosmology that was sophisticated enough, which I suspect we did, to match theirs or incorporate parts of theirs, or it was shared and we had it from even earlier. So these are the pieces you can look at to realize, hang on, it's not something that the Egyptians invented or so on. We were doing it from day dot.
Which again sort of ties in with one of the theses of your book, is that this is the way that we were meant to interact with our existence. This is the way that we were meant to interact with reality. As you mentioned at one point, I believe you're quoting somebody else, but the cathedral predates the city. The first thing that we did is we said we need to interact with reality in this manner.
Yes, that is a quote from the guy who discovered Göbekli Tepe, Dr. Klaus Schmidt. And what it means is it turns the myth of progress on its head. If you ask Neil deGrasse Tyson where religious belief came from, he will give you a mid-20th century answer, which is, you know, life before agriculture was nasty, brutish, and short. I mean, it wasn't. We lived for longer. We lost almost half a foot of height once we started growing stuff. Like, it was a disaster. But, you know, we didn't have, we kind of hung around naked. We didn't have any ideas. It was a horrible life. We suddenly somehow, don't ask why, learned to farm. Once we learned how to farm, we had surplus grain so that you start to have social differentiation and time. So people sat around the fire making up stories and they became the first priests and off we go. That's not correct. Like, archaeologically, that is fundamentally not correct, because Göbekli Tepe demonstrates that before we even lived in permanent structures, let alone knew how to farm, we built a star temple on a hill in southeast Turkey. So that which is what I'm saying about the question is the thing that survives through time rather than the answer. We were hunter-gathering, looking up at the stars, which, by the way, in the Ice Age means that there is less water in the atmosphere, right? So if you consider there's no light pollution, there's less cloud cover. If you go out into the desert and see stars today, it's life-changing. Can you imagine, like, what that would have looked like? It's no surprise to me whether or not there is a, and I suspect there is, of course, whether or not there is an extra-dimensional component to our interest in the stars. But it was the only thing on TV for tens of thousands of years, and it was in high definition. So this idea that, so basically the first thing we find that we've done, at least in the kind of northern hemisphere, is build a temple. It's the survival of the fact that we realize that life is more than its material circumstances. It has philosophy, and it has questions, and it has, I mean, it's essentially a guitar. Like, the main pillars in Göbekli Tepe hum when you slap them. So they had music, a musical star temple on a hill where presumably they made beer and that was hallucinogenic, and, you know, yeah, ate mead, and it would have been a great party, frankly. But it also shows that is the idea, that that quest is very, very old, and it's quite beautiful that our ancestors, I think it's beautiful anyway, that our ancestors were sort of grappling with the same things we're doing on this show right now.
I have sort of a confession to make about Göbekli Tepe. I as a lot of people who are listening are aware, I work a lot in middle schools and high schools teaching music to students, and I'm not always in band rooms. A lot of times I'll be in other classrooms. And I was in this one particular classroom that had a timeline of history. And it ended at Sumeria on the left-hand side. So I got a sticky note and I wrote, Göbekli Tepe, and stuck it to the end of the timeline.
Nice.
Well, good, because it's actually double the length of time. So if you think about
across the room, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, we're not just talking about, oh, this is a few hundred years before Sumeria. It's if you consider the distance between us and the Old Kingdom Pyramid Building Project as one unit of time, it's two more back. This is not like a thing we did just before we started to build the cities of Sumeria. It is so far back, and what's crucial about that is it's so far back that we just don't get any other archaeological evidence from that time. And this is one of the things that works in the favor of the Myth of Progress crowd, which is, I mean, I've just spent 8 years in London. The great chunks of Victorian London are missing. It's not even, that's like, you know, the 1800s, right? So they'll be building a road and they're like, oh, there's a whole orphanage here. It's not that they just find Roman stuff. They've lost stuff from 150 years ago and they never went anywhere. Like, London didn't move. So if you're at a 20,000 year time depth, there's just not a lot of stuff left to find. And Göbekli Tepe is this miracle because it was deliberately buried and it was mistaken as a sort of Muslim graveyard since there were Muslims there. So, you know, for 1,200 years, give or take, which meant no one disturbed it. No one dug it up. No one used the stones for anything else, because obviously you can't disturb Muslim graves. So it turns out it wasn't, and it was accidentally found, but it was because it was deliberately and carefully buried, this one little hill, and it's this jewel that we have no idea. It probably, and I write about this in the book, I think it was special because you have evidence from obsidian trade that shows that people were at least on a calendarized basis congregating there from as far afield down as Iran and into sort of central Europe, because you have obsidian trade, and obsidian, because of its molecular structure, is very easy to kind of match where it comes from. So it was probably important in that respect, but we don't actually know if there wasn't a Göbekli Tepe on every hill. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but it is a miraculous survival that indicates that at least somewhere we were as sophisticated cosmologically, and some might say more sophisticated than Neil deGrasse Tyson back then, than we are now. And we have no idea how far widespread that level of sophistication was. And I rather suspect it was very widespread, because why wouldn't it be? If we have, you know, similar brain structures and so on distributed across the world.
Yeah. And we were talking recently about the Antikythera device. I mean, here's something that came out of Greece, which we feel like, well, we understand Greece, and then we find this thing, and it's so out of place to our understanding of Greece and the technology and understanding of things they had then, that it's the fact that all we found is the remnants of one, what else are we missing?
That's, again, why I think alternate historians or people who are interested in alternate history need to really get their heads around historiography, because you can, and we do. I mean, if you can build a civilization off a tooth or an axe head. And that if you actually look at the data points that the kind of narratives of different cultures are built on, it's make-believe in a lot of cases. And that's good and bad. It's good in the sense that you can turn around to people who may be detractors and go, no, that's make-believe. And you can use the data set to form an interpretation that I think matches other information, like phenomenological information and mythology and so on. And that's really the kind of underlying story of starships, which is there are data and there are interpretations, and the interpretation we have in a materialist world is wildly unsatisfying, and it doesn't adequately, even remotely, match the data that are available from consciousness fields and geology and mythology and genetics and so on. They don't cohere correctly.
Well, and again, one of the things with the Antikythera device that I believe we talked about, Michael, I think, brought it up, was that it was specifically designed for measuring, I believe, lunar phases. So in other words, once again, it's this example of the most important thing to man in antiquity was interacting with the world in this sort of magical manner, which is something that we've completely lost.
And one of the things, and this is something I think is an indication. So there's a thesis that one of the reasons it's called starships is that there is something about getting better at understanding or measuring or thinking about space and the stars leads to what I call redundant complexity in cultures. And you have things that are astonishingly advanced that people, like, I mean, the Dogon is a famous example of it, of course, but the astronomical information that is implied, or even the physics information that's implied in places like the Giza Plateau, or some of the earlier sites in Egypt, step pyramids, going the whole way back, some of Robert Bavall's stuff. It is misinterpreted as, oh, well, these guys had spaceships because they know pi and they have the correct ratios that match the ratios of different colors of light in the spectrum. That's not correct. Like, that just isn't correct. Industrial civilizations leave a lot of waste, and they didn't have any. Nevertheless, the complexity is there, which is why I call it redundant. And that, to me, is indication of extra-dimensional contact, much like the movie Contact, frankly. The Antikythera mechanism is a very good example of how you have wobbles of complexity based on what I think is getting better at engaging with the extra-dimensional world, which is where artists and everyone, Francis Crick, whoever you want, thinks this is where ideas came from. And if you were to look for, there are no universal myths, despite what people say. Flood myths aren't universal. The sun is male isn't universal, and so on. You have an uneven distribution of them, depending on where they are. Probably the closest thing you can get to a universal myth, that being said, is the presence of civilizing demons or a civilizing trickster. It is a spirit being that either descends to Earth or emerges from the spirit world to teach us the arts of civilization, the demonic arts, metallurgy, hunting, whatever it happens to be. Now, that to me may well represent a very long-lived survival in that grandmother-grandfather sense that we were talking about. And the underlying thesis of starships is, rather than looking for aliens, what I think we have when you look at the wobbles of redundant complexity across the human timeline is instances where we have been, when we've had a higher fidelity signal with the extra-dimensional and then a lower fidelity signal with the extra-dimensional. And I may describe sort of where we are in the early 21st century, at least publicly, as a low fidelity signal.
Well, that makes sense. We seem to be so disconnected from the spiritual at this point, partially because of our focus on the material, and it doesn't seem like it's going to get better anytime soon.
Well, it will get better once it gets worse. If you look at, you know, if you're sort of trying to scenario plan the next 10 years, it doesn't look great for the next few, but it kind of has to not look great for the next few so that it starts to look great afterwards. So in the medium term, hopefully things are looking up. In the short term, they are not.
Something I wonder a lot of times is we're quick to blame society for sort of taking us away from interacting with the world in this sort of spirit world, other world capacity. But sometimes I wonder if the egg didn't come before the chicken. If perhaps our increasing reliance on the material and our increasing reliance on technology was as part of a reaction to sort of being cut off in some way from the spirit world. Now I know that is not something that everyone experiences, because there are plenty of people who do still interact with the other, as it were, and who can actually in a lot of ways seem to interact with the other at will. But I wonder, like, as a society, as a global permaculture, am I using that right? Yeah. as a permaculture, if perhaps it was a reaction to some sort of cutting off that we experienced some 300-400 years ago.
Very, very likely. I mean, as you would know, Josh, the reason I use the word demons of civilization is this is, and it's a very Jacques Vallée thing to say, and that's
right,
because he's my god, but we do not know the motives of whoever it is behind Dr. Kripal's one-way mirror for the transmission of, you know, cultural complexity, or why they appear to us in the way they do and why that appearance changes over time. And we should be suspicious of it. We don't know if we're, we don't know why. I mean, there's probably some sort of ecosystemic function of it, which is that you know, it's kind of getting into your area there, Josh, but we don't know why they do this. And there is, it's a very good example of speculation as to, well, maybe we have been cut off, maybe historically we did a deliberate cutoff, maybe we spoke to the wrong ones. once you get a model of redundant complexity as an indication of extra-dimensional contact, you then can start to have these discussions. And I think this is what, dare I say, Ancient Aliens should be. I think it should be, okay, let's pretend Jacques Vallée hosts Ancient Aliens. That's how I think we should be talking about these variations of cultural complexity and what they indicate about us and what's on the other side of the one-way mirror.
I would tune in so hard.
Oh, me too.
It wouldn't have the popularity, but the content would be amazing. And that concludes part one of our conversation with Gordon White. As I said, if you're a patron, and you can become a patron for only $3 a month and get extra content, and we're going to be doing some giveaways and some other cool stuff. You can become a patron by going to wheredidtheroadgo.com. There's a link right there for patrons, basically. If you don't want to go through the patron site, but you still want the patron benefits, contact me. You can set up a recurring payment through PayPal, which a bunch of people have done. And that way you don't have to use the patron site. The patron site does give you access to all the older patron-only material, whereas the recurring payment currently is just the current stuff. As I put it up, I send out an email to let you know where it is and how to download it. I will eventually have a member section up on the site. I am still working on it, and I am also working out some of the kinks in the forum, so bear with me on that if you're having issues. We're trying to figure out what is going on, because it works for 99% of the people. Every once in a while, it's throwing back some weird errors, and I'm looking into that as well. All right. We're done for this week. Taking you out, this is Mechanism with Mouth of God.
Legend inside us, the spirit reminds us.